Hello, and welcome to the Weekly Comic Spotlight on the Comic Book Page podcast. My name is John Mayo.
And I'm Bob Breitall. In this episode, we'll be discussing recently released comics. One from DC, one from Marvel, and at least one other. As always, we'll keep major spoilers to a minimum, but we'll discuss general plot points and storylines of the comics we review.
This is Weekly Comics Spotlight 197 for comics originally released on May 18th, 2011. Now, starting us off in DC is Batman Gates of Gotham number 1. This is one of five, and this is written by Scott Snyder, but it's telling us that the secret history of Gotham City begins here, and the solicit said that stuff in here is spinning out of what happened in the Return of Bruce Wayne miniseries by Grant Morrison. I had kind of sort of mixed feelings on this one, Bob.
I didn't remember that from the solicit, but and maybe I'm not remembering that much from the Return of Bruce Wayne, but I didn't really see stuff spinning out of that. But
I didn't see a single thing that spun out of it. Maybe I missed it too. What got me, though, and this is a problem I've been having on a couple of the Batman titles lately, is we've got a couple of Batmen wandering around. And this one, I'm going a ways through it thinking, well, you know, it's probably Bruce.
You know? I had the same thing, and it's like, you don't know which one you're dealing with. I thought that Dick had the, or maybe I'm just totally hallucinating. I thought that the bat without the circle was
that's
Bruce.
Dick Grayson, apparently.
Oh, that's Dick Grayson. I thought, I don't know. Anyway, halfway through or two-thirds of the way through, you know, he's in the Batcave with his mask off, and, you know, they're talking and stuff, and it's, oh, okay.
My
kind of interchangeable.
My first clue was about halfway through when Commissioner Gordon saying, well, if you're anything like the previous one, I'm like, oh, maybe this isn't Bruce. So I flip back, because normally what happens is on the title page, they'll have the clue telling you which one it is hidden in the blurb. No blurb. So, and the thing of it is, it's not, I mean, the costumes are too similar, and it's not like the artists have been drawing Batman perfectly on model for the last couple of decades or whatever, you know?
Yeah, they all kind of, like, mess around with it a little bit, so.
And that's fine, except when you have two, and the differences matter. So, not a big deal, but a little off-putting. The art in a couple of places here was a little kind of cartoony, and it didn't, you know, really rub me the wrong way too much, but it was noticeable, I guess, is what I want to say on that.
Yeah, I don't know. I wouldn't have used the word cartoony for it, but I kind of know what you mean. It was just like, especially apparent to me was in the opening sequence, just on the faces of these guys. I guess it's just a very simplified line structure. So, you know, in that respect, I can see the because I think animated, and I guess for DC stuff, I always, you know, lend towards that.
That's why I said cartoony, not animated.
I know.
Go to the page where he's dangling the guy off the bridge or whatever.
Yeah.
And we see his teeth kind of funny, and the next one he's. His lips are kind of elongated out almost.
Well, it's just like the way they draw Penguin's nose. I mean, that's not a nose you'd see on a person.
He's at least supposed to be deformed, though.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not a big deal, and it fit the story well enough. And actually, this artist did a fairly good job on the landscapes and the cityscapes, which is a key part of the story. So that helped. But, I mean, this looks like it could be an interesting tale, you know, involving kind of the founding families of Gotham. And I thought this was a clever way to kind of build up the backstory of Gotham City while still able to tell a modern-day tale. Because that's kind of a tough thing to do. But, you know, this was a fine first issue, but man, it just didn't knock it out of the park. None of the story elements seemed to call back to the events of Return of Bruce Wayne, which, in and of itself, not a big deal, but that is how they solicited it. And some of the characters they mentioned in the solicit of Owlman and I Ching and stuff, nowhere to be found. And I have no doubt that those characters, and probably Batwoman, since they mentioned the Kanes as one of the founding families, will show up in later issues. But while it got me interested, there was nothing in this issue that made me think it wasn't just another Batman story. Yet they're positioning it as, you know, this is going to launch all kinds of major storylines for 2011 and stuff. So, if anything, I was more depressed, I guess, or more unimpressed with the hype than the issue. The issue was fine.
It, it seemed to me like it had Big Two miniseries syndrome. And by that I mean it seemed like a story that's just fine, but you know, I didn't see anything that made it appear like it's must-read material. It seems like it's a story, it'll have Batman action, it's going to tie into a bunch of stuff, and when it's over, it maybe whatever happens in here is going to, you know, be referred to somewhere else in the DC universe, but if I had to bet based on track record, I'd probably say not.
Why couldn't this have been done in, like, the Streets of Gotham or, you know, an ongoing Batman title? Why did this need a miniseries? And you're right, it's 50-50 as to whether the events of this will have lasting repercussions or not. A lot of these miniseries these days, of which they're doing way too many, they're okay stories, but a year from now, not only will most of the readers have forgotten about it, most of the writers over at DC will have forgotten about it. Not necessarily this one in particular, but in a lot of other cases. You know, time will tell, obviously, for this one.
Right. So, I mean, I gave it a 3. I mean, it was an average issue. I mean, you know, if we start out at a 3, there was really nothing in this particular issue that notched it up for me above that level.
I would agree with that, but it at least was heading in that direction. It just couldn't make it past that. You know what
I
mean?
It was a perfectly fine comic book. I mean, there was nothing. I mean, if I was, you know, anyone who's a big Batman fan and, you know, they love Batman, this is a perfectly fine series to read. You know, there's nothing wrong with it.
Mm-hmm.
It was a Batman story. You know, it wasn't.
Well, it was a Batman family story.
Yeah, Batman families. Well,
technically, Bruce isn't in here.
I know, but if, you know, Dick's running around as Batman too. So, you know, it's like, anyway, you know, it's just, if you like Batman, you'll probably like it.
Yeah. I would agree with that.
Next up, we've got Alpha Flight 0.1, which was an interesting one because I think the artist on the ongoing series is Dale Eaglesham, isn't it?
I think so. And this was Greg Pak.
Yeah, and this was Ben Oliver and Greg Pak. And just the one thing, I liked the issue. The one thing that bothered me was the inability of the artists to draw Marina and Sasquatch on model. You know, you look at the cover and Marina and Sasquatch look like Marina and Sasquatch should look. Sasquatch in the book looks more like the old Jack Russell Werewolf by Night, really, than
That's
Sasquatch.
Fair.
And Marina is drawn with black hair, not green hair.
Well, and she's hardly in the thing. I mean, she's
hardly
such
in it, but when she is, she, you know, doesn't look like Marina.
Or
the other characters look like, she doesn't act like her either, yeah, but, you know, getting turned into a giant fish monster and killed and then resurrected will maybe do that to you.
I guess, but I've lost track of how many times these characters have apparently come back from the dead.
I thought, you know, it's like, I didn't read the Chaos War event, and, you know, it kind of starts out saying, you know, these guys were brought back from the dead in Chaos War. You got a lot of these people, and it's like, okay, fine. You know, so it's like it started out, and I remembered the characters from way back when, and, you know, so I just kind of followed along with it. And, I thought it did a good job for the most part with, you know, the story with establishing the different characters and, you know, doing the stuff. I didn't recall Shaman being able to, I guess, astrally project himself out of his body while his body autonomously, like, did complicated tasks like finishing open heart surgery, but maybe well, I something somewhere.
I thought it was nice to see Dr. Two Youngman actually practicing medicine, and
yeah,
for him to actually be a surgeon like that was a little surprising to me. And I'd kind of prefer a doctor that does open heart surgery while actually, I don't know, staying there in body, maybe even paying attention to it. I mean, that whole astral projecting thing and his body still doing the operation was completely out of left field. I don't think we have ever seen Shaman do that kind of really Doctor Strange shtick before. And he's even one-upping Doctor Strange, because usually Doctor Strange wouldn't continue with surgery.
He would. Doctor Strange would be meditating somewhere when he left his body. Yeah. You know, he wouldn't be like doing complicated things.
And, and let's face it, Shaman is no Doctor Strange. He's not even a Doctor Voodoo, for that matter. I mean, come on. I saw that, and it's like, you know, they're treating these mystics like they're interchangeable people almost. And that kind of annoyed me. Because before, he could reach into the magic bag, he could work with the spirits, that kind of stuff. We're seeing some stuff that we hadn't seen before with him. But, you know, again, coming back from the dead a few times, maybe that does something to it. Overall, I agree. They did a pretty good job setting up the characters and whatnot. I'm kind of curious why the Purple Girl, Purple Woman, you know, did what she did in this issue. She was a cool character back in the day in Alpha Flight. And for that matter, I'm curious if we're going to see more of the other Alpha Flight and Beta Flight characters in this series.
I think that they were, it appeared that they were setting something up there for, you know, like this Unity organization being some bad guy, or, you know, being an ongoing threat for the main 7-issue series that's going to be following on from this point one issue.
Almost certainly, almost certainly. Now, what I didn't get is why they felt the need to do this as a 0.1 versus just a number one, because I felt like it was a good first issue.
Yeah.
Now, again, going back to the solicit and stuff, you know, one of the things they pitched there is how the country turns against Alpha Flight. Now, again, presumably that'll happen actually in the real first issue, not the 0.1 here. But it's one of those where I think they need to be a little bit better on how they solicit some of this. You know, that having been said, I really enjoyed this, but I'm a longtime Alpha Flight fan. This was one of the first titles at Marvel I got on a regular basis back in the John Byrne days. So for me, this was a 4 out of 5.
Yeah, I gave it a 4 out of 5. Also, I mean, it was a good issue.
We'll see how they do when they transition to the, you know, regular creative team or whatever. And I hope they position the team as a viable, you know, property at Marvel. Because the original series went for 120, 130 issues, I think.
Yeah.
So. Of course, everyone since then lasted about a dozen or two.
That's true. It's hard to get things to last anymore.
It is. It's a tough market out there. And, you know, that's why I was pleased they had a very strong first issue here and a little unimpressed with the Gates of Gotham for the same reason. You know, you've got to start strong these days.
You know, the thing with the Gates of Gotham is almost like when they do these miniseries, it's almost like they don't need to bother because, you know, they're kind of like in and out and people have ordered the majority of the series by the time, you know, at least the shops, by the time the first issue comes out and, you know, it's had its, you know, sale, so.
But I think because of that, that's why we're getting more conservative orders, both from readers and retailers, and they're doing more of a kind of a wait and see and try to reorder or whatever if they need to. They've burned that bridge too many times.
Yeah. Now the last one, you want more on...
I was going to say, yeah, next up is Breed number 3, or Breed... I always do that, Breed 3 number 1. I hate titles with numbers in the title.
This one was very interesting because it's been, and maybe you looked it up.
16 years.
16 years. Okay. I know I read Breed, and I know I read Breed 2, but uh-huh. I had zero recollection of them at this point. And I was actually very pleased at the way Starlin put this story together because he starts off with some action, and he works in a way to make the exposition make some amount of sense, and it kind of drew me back into the situation and the story, you know, going on here. I thought it was well done.
I think my feelings towards this issue center around that entire issue there. The problem here is how do you restart a property that's been dormant for 16 years? You got to have some exposition to kind of set the scene back up and get going. It's almost, you know, unavoidable, but it kind of slows the story down. And I agree. The exposition was effectively done. Now, the first couple of pages were way heavy on captions and narration. We get a little action and stuff in that. We get, you know, then some actual, you know, dialogue for a little bit and stuff. But It seemed to start with a let me set the scene, let me get into some action, and then let me go into a lot more exposition. And it was good stuff. It helped. I would have liked to have had some footnotes here and there of like, oh, okay, that was what was in the first miniseries. This is what was in the second. Where did some of this other maybe happen? Because it seemed like a lot more than you could normally fit into about a, you know, six-issue miniseries maybe?
They covered a lot of ground in this issue, you know.
But again,
of stuff that went on. And like I said, I don't know how much of that was because of my lack of remembrance of those other ones. I don't know how much of that actually happened, played out in those comics, versus how much is kind of like, you know, behind the scenes backstory that's being revealed here for the first time. You know, there's a possibility that there's some of that mixed in.
Oh, there's definitely some of that mixed in, no question. You know, particularly later in the issue and stuff. Part of it also is Starlin's got enough for me of a recognizable style that when he is recounting when he was the church's handyman and he had the kind of the mask to hide his identity, it looked too much like the Weird.
Yeah, it did, except he didn't have the one big eye. But right. Other than that, he did look a lot like the Weird.
And then a page or two later, there was one guy in the background when he goes back to Elsewhere that's in color or whatever, kind of in the center of that panel, and I'm like, he seems familiar from possibly one of Starlin's other, I don't know if it was Starchild or whatever, you know, one or two other miniseries, and I'm wondering, is he building a bigger tapestry here than just what we have in the Breed? You know, it's something where I got back up to speed on where things were at. I really like Starlin's work, so I'm definitely going to stay with the series. And no doubt now that this is out of the way, things will get moving a lot faster. But it's kind of a damned if you do, damned if you don't situation. He had to do what he did in this issue, I think, to restart the property. But it's one of those, I felt the same way at the beginning of John Byrne's Next Men number one that we talked about a couple of months ago, where I felt so much of what we got here, whether it was new material or not, because of the way it was told with flashbacks and exposition, felt like it was happening in the past to get us to now so we could start the story.
Yeah, that's fair. But, you know, that said, I think that this is the kind of book where if you like Jim Starlin, for the most part, you know, although, you know, I've already had somebody on the forum saying they normally like Jim Starlin and they really didn't like this. So I don't know. I mean, I normally like Jim Starlin. I liked this. I mean, it was,
I guess it comes down to
right there for me.
If you mainly like his Marvel DC work, maybe that would be a difference.
Right.
But this seemed pretty classic Starlin to me.
Yeah. I mean, like if you've liked, you know, I remember, and maybe it's just, you know, Breed itself is not as memorable to me because it was shorter. But, I mean, I remember Dreadstar with more clarity, you know, and his, well, even his cosmic stuff, his early cosmic stuff at Marvel, like Warlock, you know.
Warlock.
A little better.
The Infinity, you know? Watch. He
yeah.
did the Infinity stuff. He did quite a bit over at Marvel. And
yeah.
But, I think that would have had a different enough flavor, though, for some people.
It fits right into the mold, though.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and I like having a single guy do the story and the art. I find when you get that, you tend to have a more focused vision, usually. You know, particularly if they've got somebody kind of helping them out and doing a solid job on the editing. And I felt that was more or less the case here.
Yeah, so I gave this a 4, also. It was a good, solid first issue, I thought. You know, a little bit of, you know, as we said, a little bit of stuff here and there that kind of pulled it down a little bit, but I think that was necessary, you know, to kind of reestablish some touch points in the series.
I would agree. I gave it a 4 also, and again, very enjoyable, and it double-edged sword. You've got a lot of exposition. People who don't like that are going to be turned off. Flip side, because of that, you've got a hell of a lot of story in this one issue. Arguably the equivalent of the previous two miniseries, you know, condensed.
Yeah. And that's a very good point here, is that even if you didn't read any Breed before, but you like Starlin, I think you can pick up this issue and just be right there and into this story. You don't have to have read those previous things. And that's really important, and I think it's really effective way of, like you said earlier, restarting something that's been dormant for so long.
Yeah, and I totally agree. I don't think you need to have read the first two Breed. You get everything you need here. I think if you really like what you see here, you may want to go pick those trades up, though, just to get the full feature-rich version of those stories.
Yeah. So I only we're recording this early because I'm going to be at the Phoenix Comic Con on the day we normally record. So I only just opened the box like 2 hours before we were recording this episode, and I actually read these three issues and a couple of other things. One of the things that I read was Booster Gold number 44, which is the next piece of Flashpoint.
That's the only other thing I've had time to read.
And
so, yeah,
we talked about Flashpoint last week, and as people may recall, I was not completely enthused about it. I really enjoyed this issue of Booster Gold, though. I thought this was an extremely well-done issue. I'd almost feel like having this come out before Flashpoint number one as kind of a prologue or lead-in to it might have been more effective in my eyes.
I think in this issue, Booster Gold, they do a much better job establishing this is indeed the timeline for the mainstream DC universe. We're not in some alternate timeline, some parallel world, or anything of the sort. I was a little confused how Booster wound up where he was, particularly the whole scene with the refrigerator. I'm okay with him having kind of been left alone as the timeline, you know, resolved itself or whatever. What I didn't understand is how come, you know, his sister and Rip Hunter were suddenly gone. You know, and maybe there's more to it. Maybe we'll get all that kind of fleshed out. I also found that when they go back to the chalkboard of, you know, cryptic sayings or whatever, you know, again, most of those I think we talked about last week have pretty much been, you know, already kind of clear what they're referencing and stuff. They're not as cryptic as some of what we got, and you know, I forget if it was 52 or whichever it was.
I think you need to just hang around Rip Hunter's place, and if crazy stuff starts showing up on his chalkboard, you wanna watch out, because that's a portent of bad stuff coming.
What you need to do is you need to put a web camera facing that chalkboard, and on the other end is Batman and the Batcomputer. You know, it's like they see something, they figure out what the hell it means. This was some good stuff. It's going to be interesting to see, you know, kind of where they go with some of this. You know, how Booster plays in, when he hooks up with the Flash, if he does, because they're right now the only two who seem to remember the real timeline. And then, of course, you know, what's going on with Rip and stuff. I think that this is certainly going to help Booster Gold's sales, because it's very much a key part of Flashpoint. I think that's a good thing. You know, I believe it's already gone into a second printing, because it sold out pretty quick. You know, again, because it probably was under-ordered.
Yeah. Really well done. This is, like you said, I think this is an issue that should, you know, show an uptick from the previous Booster Gold issue sales because of the crossover and, you know, for subsequent issues that are tied into Flashpoint. At least as word of mouth starts getting around, because it was, in fact, a very well-done issue.
Well, and again, Dan Jurgens on story. He's doing some of the art. Norm Ratman's kind of finishing up the art and stuff. So very, very solid art team. Great story. You know, name creators, which is something some of the other Flashpoint titles don't have. This could easily take Booster Gold into the upper echelon of the sales charts.
Yeah. Very happy, though, with that. I read two other comics that are worth mentioning, and the first one is The Rocketeer Adventures from IDW, and I won't go into, you know, any kind of story specifics or anything on this. It's just there's three stories in here. The first one, story and art by John Cassaday, really nicely done. I mean, John Cassaday does a really nice job of capturing the kind of period feel and, you know, kind of Dave Stevens kind of feel for the characters. And it was a cute, fun little story. And then the last story was written by Kurt Busiek with art by Michael Kaluta. And this one was a phenomenal story. Really nice art. Really well done. Those two stories alone made the issue worth getting. The middle story in the issue was by Mike Allred, and I like Mike Allred just fine. I don't think his style is that good of a match for Rocketeer, and that's just a personal thing. I mean, the story was just fine.
Allred has a very pronounced style, and I agree. It doesn't seem like something that I would have necessarily would have meshed with the Rocketeer.
Yeah. But the other two stories, they felt really good. So loved the issue, well worth getting. And then I read Little Depressed Boy number 4, which kind of took a little turn. You know, got a little dark at the end, which actually makes a bit of sense because it's called Little Depressed Boy. And I don't know if anybody's been reading this series. Things have been going his way a little too much, for him to be, called Little Depressed Boy. And some stuff happens in this issue, so I think that he's going to be depressed. Now, on the flip side, I'm not sure that I want to read something about someone moping around that's all depressed.
I was going to say, I don't need to read a comic for that.
Yeah. I'll have to wait and see how the next issues play out, though. I mean, I really like the story. It's, kind of like a nice little romantic piece that's, the relationship of this guy. I like Cena Grace's art on it. It was well done. So, anyway, those are the two that I read that were worth mentioning there. And that'll do it for me.
Yeah, I got my stuff last night, but I was recording the trades episode later than usual in the process, so I did that last night and only had time to get around to the couple. This was a huge week for me. This was about 54 items this time. I got two trades. I got the Adventures of Dr. McNinja and Endangered. I'll get to those eventually. Trades have a bad habit of sitting around, unread for ages. But I got about another 50 comics or something above that.
Well, so, there's a lot of comics.
There is. There's a ton. And it... and we've talked about this a couple of times. I mean, the ones I got that have expiration dates, obviously, Breed is a miniseries. Gates of Gotham is a miniseries. Captain America First Vengeance, this is the last issue of Darkness Four Horsemen. DC Universe Online Legends has an ending point. The Doctor Who Fairy Tale Life has an ending point. Green Hornet Aftermath, this is the last issue of Hawkeye Blind Spot. I got the Namor Annual, so that's one of those that's kind of, is it part of the Namor series? Is it not, in terms of do you count it as an ending thing or not? But I guess it's ongoing until they cancel that title. Rocketeer Adventures, again, short term, same with Science Dog Special, Sigil, Silver Surfer, Scar, King of the Savage Land, Ultimate Avengers versus New Ultimates, X-Men Prelude, the giant-size X-Men. I mean, there's just a lot of these that, the publishers are really shooting themselves in the foot by, putting out so many things that I can only get for such a short duration.
Yeah.
But, hey, that's their choice.
Yeah. I guess, one other thing I thought I'd bring up, because I'd meant to bring this up when we recorded the Mayo Report, and I forgot to. But I see all the time, because I've been trying to, we talk about this on the show, I've been trying to cut down on my stuff. And, so different conversations occur, on, why comics, some comics do better than other comics and, all these kind of things. But someone made a statement, you see this all the time, but, it's just like, put the best writers you can find with the best artists and let them do their thing, and this is... kind of a statement you see all the time. Why don't they just do that? And I was thinking about that, and I think that I'm going to see what you think about my premise here is that the concept of just taking the best writers and the best artists and letting them do their thing, aside from lots of other factors, it just doesn't track with wanting to publish 80 to 100 titles a month. I just don't think there are that many great writers and artists working out in the industry right now to allow that to happen. And what really happens is you fall back on Sturgeon's Law, which is essentially, 80% of everything is crud, you know, and you can look at this, you know, from different points of view, but I think that there's so many books out there right now that the 20% of stuff that's not crud is plenty of books, you know, on a sliding scale for different people. But for most people that are getting, you know, maybe 20, 30, 40 books a month, I think you can easily get only books that you personally feel are, you know, high 4 out of 5 or 5 out of 5 books. And, well, you know, I often think about this when I see people on the forums and they're like, man, I, you know, I dropped this book immediately and I read it and it's like, oh, it wasn't that bad. But, you know, it's like I think back and it's like, well, if I was only getting 40 books, would I be getting this book? Chances are no, you know.
Well, and a couple of years ago, I had to actually make a lot of those decisions when I was between jobs. I mean, I got down to where I was only getting, I think, 42 or 43 books. And if I'd had to go another month, that probably would have cut in half. You know, but the thing about that whole premise of, you know, just get the best writer, best artist, put it on the best property, done. That, to me, is such a gross over-trivialization of the problem as to be, you know, a bit scary to a degree. And, you know, I there are some people who see the world in very simple terms. There are some people who see it in very detailed, specific terms. I tend to gear more towards that specific detailed thing just out of necessity, because of my food allergies, just because of other things, you know, in just my personality and stuff. So the first fundamental flaw I see with the just put the best people in the best properties, how do you decide who's best on you know, what scale, what criteria? Now, the obvious thing would be to replace best with best selling. Figuring whether the market's right or wrong, you're at least making money. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So there's a huge subjective aspect to that. And I think in some cases we could probably, if we take out personal taste, and again go back to dollars and cents, we could probably figure out, okay, you know, people like Bendis, Grant Morrison, a few others are bankable writers. A couple of people are very bankable artists. Couple of properties tend to show up at the top. They must be bankable artists, or properties, I mean. Now, maybe that artist and that writer can work together. Maybe they're even appropriate for that property and all of that gels. Maybe it doesn't. You could have three perfect things that are just, you know, at odd angles and don't mesh. And the whole Sturgeon's Law thing of, you know, X percent of stuff is great, X percent is crap, certainly I think is true. But man, wouldn't it be wonderful if even the stuff that was crap was so much better than a lot of what we're getting today?
You know, it'd be nice.
If you could find the perfect people to put on the perfect titles and kind of balance everything out to where, you know, rising tides lift all ships kind of a thing, that would be awesome.
Well, I guess, you know, also it's like different people have different bars for what they consider to be crap, you know, and that's a very sliding scale. I mean, I read a lot of things, and I think they're perfectly fine. And, you know, other people are very quick, if something's not perfect, to, you know, just dismiss it as total crap.
Well, I totally agree with that. And, you know, I've often heard, you know, whenever people hear about how much I get, how much you used to be getting and stuff, is, you know, the comeback is, well, how could there be that many, you know, 5 out of 5 kind of books? Well, there's not. I don't need it to be a 5 out of 5 to read it. And I think if any creator who pushes that kind of a mentality, that kind of a criteria, is really shooting themselves in the foot, unless they're spinning gold on every tale they ever tell. Because every creator is going to have a bad day. Even if they don't, it's not going to click with everybody. So, you know, anytime I see, and frequently it's coming from creators of, well, I don't have time to read it, and there's just not that many perfect books out there. That's true. You can learn stuff from bad books too, and that may help you write a better book. You know, so I totally agree with the sliding scale. What does it take to go from an average book to a bad book to a great book? You know, where is that delineation, and is it a gradual scale, or is it a very stair-stepped kind of a thing where you go from, oh my god, it's brilliant, to it's just average, to oh my god, it's crap, and there's no other steps?
Yeah, and you know, there's another nuanced phase in there. It's not anything to do with, well, I mean, I think it has a relationship to quality, and that's when you take some of these popular properties and you just grow and grow and grow them. And you can look at the Batman family at DC as a for instance. You can look at the Avengers franchise at Marvel. You can look, and I think,
well, if I'm going to look at either the Batman franchise or the X-Men franchise, I need a wide angle lens. They're so damn big.
But my point is you know, or even you go over to Dynamite and you know, it's like various things, you know, it's like when they start putting out a whole bunch of books, you know, you're starting to diffuse the creators that you can, you know, they can't do everything. You know, you got like 10 Batman books. Some of those are going to be better than other ones, at least from the point of view of any observer. And it might be a different set for each different person that are their favorite three. But, you know, someone's, you know, there's 10 books. Or some, you know, person's in, I think three of them are maybe excellent. Three of them are total garbage. And the other ones are somewhere in the middle, maybe.
I think it goes further than that. And I think you're totally right there. You get 10 titles in a franchise, people are going to rate them how they think, and no two people may agree on all of it, but they're each going to buy whatever the top X amount they can afford or justify is. But I think the thing where it goes further than that is kind of the paradox of choice there. Of it's one thing if I just have one Batman or one X-Men book, it's like either I get it or I don't, done. It's by definition going to be the best Batman book available because it's the only one. But now that I've got Gates of Gotham, Batman Dark Knight, Batman, Batman and Robin, Detective, help me out here, what are some of the other just Batman-titled books?
Oh,
but you know
geez.
What I mean, there's,
you know,
there's
know,
another
I
four
know exactly
or five.
What you mean. There's a whole bunch of them.
The fact that we can't remember all of the names in and of itself says something.
Yeah.
And now,
I mean,
if we
you
decide...
got, you know, if you count Superman, Batman in there, you know, you've got... Well, you know, Batman, Batman and Robin, Batman the Dark Knight, Batman Gates of Gotham, Batman Inc., Batman Europa, you got the Superman Batman, and then when you add in, you know, you got Batman Arkham City, you got Batman Beyond, which is sort of not really a Batman title, you got, you know, Batman Odyssey, when Adams can put out a thing. But I mean, there's just
one.
A lot. And then you got the Batman family ones, like, you know,
let's take a
Gotham
hypothetical
City Sirens and stuff, you know.
A hypothetical reader. Back in the day, they would stand in front of the rack, they say, hey, you know, I like Batman, what should I get? They would see Batman, maybe Brave and the Bold, Detective, that'd be about it, World's Finest, back in the day. Okay? Obviously for me, back in the day is somewhere in the early 80s. Just for anyone wondering. These days...
And interestingly, those exact same four titles back in the early 70s you know, to choose from.
Funny how that works.
Yeah.
They were the evergreens and they stuck around. But it was one of those, you got those. And it wasn't a, gee, did I make the wrong choice? Because, I mean, they were few enough and cheap enough, you could really get them all for the most part. But these days, you know, there's not only which one do I get, but there's going to be that nagging doubt of, did you get the right one? Is that the one you're really going to like the best? Maybe you would have liked Batman Inc. better. Maybe Batman Dark Knight. Maybe Batman and Robin. Maybe, you know, Batman Superman. You know, whatever. And that is going to make it harder to enjoy whichever one or ones, unless you get them all, or even if you do get them all, that you do get. You know, you just can't enjoy it as much because there's that, I don't say the buyer's remorse, but you know what I mean.
You know, did I pick the right one? If you're not getting them all, and the other piece of that puzzle is, and this is something that came up on that thread where I'm managing my want list, but you know, other people are chiming in on it. You know, when I asked you whether it was on that one or maybe it was on the
What did I buy for May? Yeah,
you know, I saw that, you know, because you had kind of liked Warlord of Mars when it came out, and then you had started getting Deja Thoris, and then I saw that you're only getting Deja Thoris, and now they also had this
Whatever the Barsoom was.
Warlords of Barsoom or whatever the heck it's called. But, you know, there's another title in that same universe, and it's just kind of, you know, your statement was, hey, I like the Warlord of Mars. It was okay, but, you know, I really don't want to get three of them.
This is where I think Dynamite and IDW in particular are shooting themselves in the foot so badly it's not even funny. I mean, just start dropping cannonballs on it, it'd be faster. because they both do it. They'll take a property and then it's like, oh, let's not do one, let's do five. You know, be it Green Hornet, be it you know, they're doing a couple of Doctor Who miniseries, the Transformer stuff over at IDW. Both of these publishers have a very, particularly on a licensed property, very bad habit of overextending. And, you know, I'm enjoying Green Hornet fine enough, but when they were doing, you know, three or four Green Hornet titles, two Kato titles, and, you know, something else it seemed like, it's like, well, maybe I should back off. Now, they did it for me. But it's the same thing with you know, the Warlord of Mars. You know, if it was just the one title, I'd probably keep going that for a while. And I may, and I'm not like saying, oh, I'm never going to get it again. It's just it didn't make the cut for the order.
And I really like Warlord of Mars. And I really, really like it. It's one of my top of the stack books. And then, okay, they put out Deja Thoris. And I'm like, okay, now there's two. And it's a good book. It's written by the same guy, you know, so it's of similar quality. You know, title character barely wears any clothes, so it's easy on the eyes. You know, they got a good artist on it, and you know, so it's like, okay, you know, I'm reading that one too. And then they come out with this third one, and when they come out with the third one, it's a different writer. It's set 100,000 years before the events in these other ones, and I'm like, you know, do I really need to be getting a third one? But then, you know, DCBS went and had the first issue for like 99 cents or something. So it's like, okay, well, I'll at least try the first issue. But, you know, it's getting to the point where if they, and I think that if I don't like it, I can drop just that one and be just fine. But, you know, for these ones that are sent concurrently with one another, you know, those are the kinds of cases where I'm just as likely, if I stop getting one, I will stop getting them all.
Yeah, and I've done that in the past. There have been times where, you know, I backed out of the Wildstorm universe. I wound up getting them, you know, back issues later, but I needed to make some cuts. That was an easy place. I didn't drop one, I dropped them all. And typically in the past, and I'm talking over the last 30 years, you know, I would not drop titles, I would drop imprints, I would drop publishers. And it's because of the interconnectedness. And I like the interconnectedness of titles. I find that fun. But there's also a point of overkill. You know, the size right now of the X-Men franchise and the Batman franchise specifically at Marvel and DC, I think is very excessive. And, you know, I think something like Gates of Gotham is going to get lost in the mix. You know, it's they're putting too much out. In two, in you know, the Gotham City case, literally in the span of one city, it's just too crowded in there.
Yeah.
Now you could argue Batman Inc.'s all over the globe, but the point is, you know what I mean?
Yeah, I know exactly what you mean, and it's just, you know, as your average reader is, you know, kind of like looking at, okay, how many books can I get? How many books can I afford? How many books do I have time to read? How many books, you know, whatever their gating factor is on it, they're going to be making decisions. And publishers are leading people to decision points sometimes that maybe don't need to be led to, you know?
Well, and again, there's the two types. There's the jump off point, which I talked about in my last article. And what I'm probably going to talk about either in my next article or the one after, depending when all these Flashpoint miniseries hit, is the decision point of, do you get on a new title? Because that's where I think DC just totally botched it on Flashpoint. You know, his power is his curse. No, his solicitation is his curse. Nobody's going to buy that book. It's foolish. I think they're really doing themselves a disfavor by and large. And for me, I mean, there's certain heuristics I'll use, certain guidelines of, you know, am I really into this property? Do I really like the character or the artist or the writer? Or, you know, am I getting it for the big picture of the universe or whatever? I like the dialogue snappy, the concept's cool, whatever, you know, that I'll use to guide my decisions. And you have very different ones.
Yeah.
You know, for you, you stated this on one of the threads, if it's a licensed property, I think it was Batman Beyond you were referring to, you'll just go watch the cartoons, you know, which is cool. But for me, some of these things that are licensed properties, Doctor Who, Batman Beyond, you know, or whatever, that I really enjoy, I'll follow into the comics. Other times, if it doesn't translate well, I won't.
I think a lot of people are that way, which is why there's so many licensed comics. You know, I kind of go against model there because, again, I'm more just trying to cut things out because, not necessarily because I wouldn't enjoy them, but there's so many things that I would enjoy that I just don't have enough time to read them all. So, you know, I want to cut back, not because I can't afford them, but I can't afford the money. It's I can't afford the time on a lot of these things. And, you know, taking something that's adapted from another medium into comics, you know, I just say, okay, I'm just going to cut most of those things off because, you know, I take time. I'm like 2.5, what is it, on the 5th season of Doctor Who? Or even the 6th?
6th.
So I've only gone through the first 2 seasons of Doctor Who. So I've got, of the new relaunch of Doctor Who. You know, so I've got plenty of Doctor Who to watch, you know, and it's like I look at, you know, Dollhouse, and it's like, do I need to get the Dollhouse comic? Well, I still haven't watched the whole 2nd season of Dollhouse, you know, and do I need to, you know, Batman Beyond? Well, it's like I've watched probably about 5 of the cartoons in my life. I liked them just fine, but I mean, it went for, I don't know, like 80 or 90 shows or something, 60, some number of shows. I mean, there's
easily 65, okay, possibly as high as 100. I don't know.
There's plenty of them out there, you know, that if I want more Batman Beyond, I sit down and I can a little more passively watch a show with it. And that's just me, you know, but it's kind of an easier decision point for me because there are so many things that are adapted that, you know, I was reading them and I was liking them just fine. But, you know, I got the one-shot Dollhouse. I'm not going to get the follow-up series. I'm not going to get the True Blood series from IDW. I'm not going to get the Doctor Who series, even though I like Doctor Who, you know. Batman Beyond, and they're going to... I'm kind of preemptive on that one because I kind of got wind on the internet that they're going to be expanding that franchise to include like a Superman Beyond.
And I think a Justice League
Beyond. And it's like, you know, okay, that's 3 whole series I don't need get.
I think what it comes down to is everyone's kind of a snowflake in that regard. They all have, you know, we each have our own decision criteria or whatever. And obviously there will be exceptions to every rule we have. These are guidelines. But I think it would be very interesting for both of us and our listeners to kind of to think through what are those kind of, you know, general rules or heuristics we use when filling out an order to figure out, you know, it's like, okay, for me, it's if it's mainstream DC, it gets a default yes. There may be a few things that kick it off. You know, in other cases, stuff stays off the list. There needs to be something that kicks it on, you know. But it would be interesting if we got enough people to kind of post those kinds of you know, here's the general rules they use to see if there are some common threads.
Well, now, the other part that's interesting is, and I think more people are like this than people who actually look at an order form and pre-order, are the people who just go into the shop, look at the rack, and buy stuff because they see it at the store.
Yes, you know? And I think that's a similar, both end result and similar thing, but it's a different enough process because I think the way you pre-order and the way you pick stuff off the rack, different decision processes happen. Covers were a little bit more important. Where it is on the rack may actually influence, and if it's on the rack is certainly a factor.
Right. But also, when it's on the rack, I can actually, and I've seen people do this in the shop. I mean, they pick up a book,
yep,
they flip through it, and they're not reading it, they're looking at the art, you know, and if it does not grab them, they put it back on the rack.
Yep.
And I've seen people pick up books that I love, and they flip through them, and they put it back on the rack, you know.
And that's part of why I think it's a fundamentally different decision process.
Yeah, it is. And, you know, that's where, like, the Flashpoint thing, that's where it doesn't matter what kind of one cryptic line they, you know, solicited it with, for a, you know, what that will help the retailer decide whether they're going to stock enough copies of it in their shop. But once it's on the shop, then if it's there for someone to flip through, then it's going to be how much does that art knock somebody's socks off when, and that concept knock somebody's socks off when they pick that book up off the rack and look at it. The other decision point that'll be interesting to me there is the whole process of, okay, there's five Flashpoint books sitting here.
Budgeting's a very different thing that way.
That's $15 on top of everything else that I've got in my hand here. You know, well, which ones do I get, and do I make that decision of, oh, well, there's so many, I'm just not going to get any.
The big question I have on that, because I've, even when I was buying stuff off the rack, I was, in my mind, pre-ordering. You know, I knew what I was getting based on what was in previews as far back as, you know, the 20 years ago, 30 years ago, I was doing this for the most part. And the question I have for people who get stuff solely off the rack, they go into the store with really no idea or no checkoff list of here's what came out this week that I'm picking up. Are they mainly looking at what came out this week and saying, okay, there's three Flashpoints, five, ten, there's too many, whatever, and saying, okay, let me just, I won't get that? Or do they look at what is just currently on the rack in total? In that case, if something didn't make the cut for Flashpoint or whatever, you know, some comic didn't make it last week, what's the likelihood of it making it on the list the following week or the week after? Or is it no longer new and therefore not under consideration? Because I really think it's that first week of release that matters on most books.
No, I think you're right.
But, you know, I'd love to kind of hear the
for
the
people
process.
Who go regularly to the shop.
Yeah, well, right? Again, both regularly to the shop and those who pre-order.
Right, you know. But I mean, some people might only wander into the shop every 2 or 3 weeks, in which case they would...
Everything in the 2 or 3 is effectively new to them.
Right.
Yeah. But then, once they've seen it the once and come back and didn't, you know...
Right.
If they turn it down the once, do they pick it up later is the question.
Right, and that is a really interesting question, because they've made the decision... I guess it depends on the kind of decision. It might have been, hey, this looks interesting, but I don't have enough money in my pocket right now to get it. So if they're back in the shop the next week and they have some extra money, then they might pick it up. Whereas if they made the decision, this does not look interesting, they're probably not going to revisit it.
Certainly if they're not interested, they're not interested. And I agree, that's a very key distinction to make. But I also wonder if the new shiny factors in enough that when DC releases all three Green Lantern titles in the same week, you know, if that hurts, whereas if they had split it across, that would have helped. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And that's something that, again, you know, I'll when I go through the next order form, I'll try to jot down some notes as to kind of the thought process I use. I mean, really, for me, when I go through the order form, a lot of it's, yeah, I'm getting these titles, so, you know, it's just a matter of figuring out new titles or if I discontinue something, which I don't do all that often. So it'd be interesting. So anything else? That pretty much do it.
I think that does it.
Cool.
Join us next week when we discuss Strange Adventures number 1 from DC, Secret Warriors number 27 from Marvel, and Incorruptible number 18 from Boom Studios.
The show notes and forum for this podcast can be found at www.comicbookpage.com under the podcast and forum sections of the website. Please email us at theguys@comicbookpage.com and let us know what you think of what was discussed in this episode. Thanks for listening.